All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a chilly and damp 42 degrees with mist here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Nanotech, Mining, Al Gore, Biocontrol, Walmart Robo Bees, and Camille. We had Camille on as a guest on Friday. Hi, Camille. It was a good conversation, something that we don't get to do too often. We talked about a lot of different things. The biocontrol was actually a program by DARPA where they were looking for bidders to be able to control from nanometers to centimeters, seconds to weeks, biomolecules to entire populations of organisms using embedded controllers made of biological parts to program system-level behavior. And we kind of raised an eyebrow. And I think today we might go a little bit down that path to see where it leads us. So biocontrol. So how they're going to do that is utilizing different forms of very tiny electronics to be able to bag, tag, and track everything that is going on in our environment. We talked about smart dust. I don't know if that was last show or the show before. And some of the things that have been developed in the past. Hewlett-Packard has had a program going since the 90s that I'm aware of personally. And they now have their nervous system of Earth where they are working with some of the mining companies to track different types of oil wells and things of that nature. So we had run across a story on Friday about It's a Small, Small World, and they talked a lot about nanotech and how they were going to use them to develop large fleets or swarms of tiny little robots. We found out that a lot of these robots, one of the things, they're not little metal tin can robots. They are nanotech robots, meaning they are at a very minuscule scale that you need an electron microscope to be able to view. But they can be out of all kinds of different materials from the periodic table. They have also been able to build biological nanorobots utilizing DNA. We've read a lot about the DNA. And the way they create these little DNA nanorobots is by folding them appropriately to be able to fold and unfold, to be able to do the things that they need them to do. And they came up with that whole process at Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering when they were developing the RoboBees, trying to figure out how to mass produce them. They came up with a way called origami, where you can fold different ways, so when you put a little zap electrical pulse through it, all of a sudden it goes bloop and it self-assembles. This is pretty frightening stuff. So I found a brand new story. This one's from 2 days ago, nanowork.com. DNA origami is a novel avenue for creating next-generation optical voltage sensing nanodevices. Now, one of the things we've already seen is they've been using DNA origami to build these little DNA nanobots that they're saying they'll be able to put cancer-killing drugs into and then put them into your bloodstream and have them target the exact area of the tumor and deliver precision medicine to your tumor. Well, they also want to use them for other things. The term membrane potential offers the electrical potential difference between the inside of a cell and its surrounding extracellular fluid. And the phenomenon is present in all cells, but it is equally important in nerve and muscle cells. And in these cells, changes in the membrane potentials are used to code and transmit information. Now, of course, that's what they want to do inside of the human body, is to code and transmit, to be able to remotely control. It's called biological control, right? There are a number of biomedical topics that could be understood better by having more effective sensors to accurately quantify the potential across cellular membranes. For instance, Alzheimer's disease, and we're going to look at that in a minute, has been linked to disruptive end plate potential activity, and that is the chemically induced change in the electrical potential of the motor end palate. And the portion of the muscle cell membrane that lies beyond the opposite of a terminus nerve fiber at the neuromuscular junction. Apart from neurodegenerative diseases, the areas that could benefit include muscular processes and the effect of neurotoxins and poisons on an organism, as well as stimulating brain activity for the purpose of developing artificial intelligence. Over the past decade, researchers have developed various optical voltage sensor probes in order to overcome the highly invasive nature of electrode-based techniques. And that would be putting nanowires into your skull and flashing LED lights into your brain. These voltage sensing mechanisms can be hampered by some combinations of limitations, including low sensitivity, low kinetics, or heavy capacitive loading. This has motivated our research efforts to explore DNA nanotechnology for developing novel optical voltage sensing nano devices that can convert a local change of electrical potential into optical signals. So what does that mean? Maybe we should scroll down a little bit. We provide a method for sensing the difference in potential across a membrane, blah, blah, blah. The team used DNA origami as the building material for the sensor, which is a simple technique and allows the structure and the size of the sensor to be adapted to different environments and situations. DNA works well as a material for voltage sensing as it is inherently charged and therefore can be manipulated and respond to changes in the surrounding potential. Now, it sounds like they are using living material to create some sort of nano-based sensor to be utilized in some sort of biological organism. This is exciting, and it almost sounds like they're making like a little computer system. This is exciting, as with our work as a basis of a proof of concept, there are many possibilities of adapting the design to increase its sensitivity and therefore further its potential applications. Of course, they never come out and say exactly what they are. The flexibility of DNA nanoassemblies will allow the researchers to target the sensor design on a case-by-case basis. And in addition to its programmability of the overall shape of the DNA templated structure, the key strength of this technique lies in its ability to attach to various chemical functionalities. That'd be things such as fluorescent dyes, cholesterol moieties, or proteins with base pair precision. So that'd be at a DNA level. This feature also allows for quick adaption of designs to a particular experimental requirement, and eventually this could lead to mass production of different types of nano-sized sensors. And an important aspect of this novel system compared to other ontogenetic approaches, that's the first I've ever heard, ontogenetic approaches, O-N-T-O, genetic. It could be added externally to cells, and there is no need to mess with the genome, which may help with the eventual application in humans. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. You knew that was coming. There are various aspects to their nano sensors that the team is now tackling. They will adapt the design in order to enhance the sensitivity on the voltage, and they plan to combine the sensor with a biological system to conduct measurements in living cells and possibly in simple organisms, and then they will explore the targeting of the structure to certain cell types by adapting the DNA origami. You know, I ran across a very high-resolution poster the other day that you could blow up and print at a very large size. It's titled Structural DNA Nanotechnology Poster, and I will link this in the notes. I've had things such as this printed at like a 30 by 50 and laminated before, and they're pretty damn cool. And I'm almost thinking this might be a nice gift for me someday that I might share with my family, because it's pretty neat. But it's got all the different shapes of DNA nanotech that they've made, and there's little hexagons and spirals and little weaves, like it looks like someone braided it together, and there's like a three-way braid and a four-way and an eight-way braid and twists. And then they actually have stars. and smiley faces, which I'm sure that's some sort of joke. The smiley face probably zippity zaps your brain and makes you happy. I don't know. And then there's the dodecahedron, which we read about, I don't know, a week or two ago. We were looking at some new DNA nanotech stuff, and the different shapes had different functionalities. And it's a lot like programming proteins and things of that nature to be able to interlock with receptors on cells. So, okay, now we're going to move a little bit forward, and we are going to find the story. Dissecting artificial intelligence to better understand the brain. Now, we've discussed before the whole brain initiative, and this isn't just an United States initiative, though it was edicted by a, what do they call them, executive order. But they introduced a whole program with all kinds of funding to crack the secrets of the brain. And, of course, DARPA, more affectionately known as the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, has been very involved in a lot of that research to cure injured soldiers in the field, whether that be through traumatic brain injury or loss of limbs, being able to conquer the secrets of the brain, maybe even cure PTSD, has been an initiative of theirs. And with the brain initiative itself, we have research going on in every institution. We see that there's a lot of research going on in stroke and how to cure the brain after stroke. But a lot of this research is also being pointed toward how to create a synthetic neuron and a synthetic brain for general artificial intelligence. So, dissecting artificial intelligence to better understand the human brain. This is out of MedicalExpress.com, March 25th, 2018. In a natural world, intelligence takes many forms. It could be a bat using echolocation to expertly navigate in the dark, or an octopus quickly adapting its behavior to survive in the deep ocean. Likewise, in the computer science world, multiple forms of artificial intelligence are emerging, and we should be afraid, be very afraid. Different networks, each trained to excel in a different task. And as will be presented today at the 25th annual meeting of the Cognitive Neuroscience Society, cognitive neuroscientists increasingly are using those emerging artificial networks to enhance their understanding of one of the most elusive intelligence systems, and that would be the human brain. The fundamental questions cognitive neuroscientists and computer scientists seek to answer are similar, says Ode Olivia of MIT. They both have complex systems made of components. For one, it's called neurons, and for the other, it's called units. And we are doing experiments to try to determine what those components calculate. In Olivia's work, which she is presenting at the symposium, neuroscientists are learning much about the role of contextual cues in human image recognition. By using artificial neurons, which are essentially lines of code and software, with neural network models, they can parse out various elements that go into recognizing a specific place or an object. The brain is a deep and complex neural network, says Nicholas something Criscorti of Columbia University, who is chairing the symposium. Neural network modules are brain-inspired models that are now state-of-the-art in many artificial intelligence applications, such as computer vision. And we have talked much about robot googly eyes and how they really have kind of led the way in the explosion of AI and good old NVIDIA, who came out with some of the first and the most advanced graphical processing units, because they have been a gaming company that had created video cards back in the day. They now have jumped into the lead for a lot of the computing power for AI. The machine intelligence programs can learn very quickly when given lots and lots of data, and that's what the problem seems to be right now for all of these agencies. They've been collecting billions of gigabytes, petabytes, whatever you want to call it, and storing it away somewhere in some big database, but there's just too much data to to parse through, so now they need some big pulsating brain in the sky with the ability to see, to start parsing through and collating this data. This allows them to parse contextual learning at a very fine level. And while it is not possible to dissect human neurons at such a level, the computer model performing a very similar task is entirely transparent. Artificial neural networks serve as mini brains that can be studied, and we're going to look again at mini brains. They can be studied, changed, evaluated, and compared against responses given by human neural networks, so the cognitive neuroscientists have some sort of sketch on how a real brain may function. These models have helped neuroscientists understand how people can recognize objects around them in a blink of an eye. And this involves millions of signals emanating from the retina that sweep through a sequence of layers of neurons, extracting semantic information. For example, what we're looking at in a street scene with several people and a dog, and current neural network models can perform this kind of task using only computations that biological neurons can perform natively. Moreover, these neural network models can predict some of the extent to how a neuron in the deep brain will respond to any image. So now let's take it a step further. So we have places such as DARPA. Uh-oh, hold on. A video just started. We have places such as DARPA who have been working on replicating different pieces of the human body in digital form. And some of these have been the brain and the body on the chip projects. We've been reading a lot about microfluidics recently. There were quite a few stories we have covered where they are able to take stem cells and put them into almost a little plastic chip. I don't know what it's made out of, but in my brain it's plastic, with a little chamber inside of it that has electrodes going into it. They can put stem cells, usually those iPS stem cells that they can make out of the skin, scrape them, mix them up in a little petri dish with some chemicals. They go back to native stem cells that then can be coaxed to become any type of stem cell throughout the body. And they create biological electronic hybrids that mimic your, or whoever the experiment was done on, biological processes. So they've been working on growing mini brains and petri dishes for a while. Well, here's a newer story titled Microfluidic Mini Brains, Keeping Up with the Brain on a Chip Technology. The head traumas described in Edwin Smith's Papyruses, among other medical states, represents proof of neuroscience's interest 1,500 years before. However, with years of study, much remains unknown about the central nervous system, as asserted by diseases increased greatly that we have no cure for. As an example, the prevalence of autism went from 6.8 per 1,000 in 2000 to 14.6 in 2012. And as well, due to the aging population, a number of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's is also expanding. And remember, Alzheimer's was now considered an epidemic. The World Health Organization said nearly 1 billion people in the world have a neurological disorder, including epilepsy, Alzheimer's disease, or a cerebrovascular accident, which would be a stroke, as well as neural infections, etc., or even mental illness. There is an increasing need for an in vitro model to assess the neurotoxicological effects of therapeutic drugs on the brain, and also to study neurological diseases by analyzing the functionalities and the interactions of brain regions. In vivo models with mice or rat brains have been widely used but are limited, though they can let those mini brain balls grow, those were human ones at least, in a petri dish for a year and then implant them into a rodent. But it has been observed in animal testing that methods are not enough to correctly predict drug efficacy and pick out the advantages of alternative methods. Moreover, neuronal plasticity, which is one of the main reasons of brain complexity, is difficult to reproduce with existing traditional in vitro models. So now an efficient brain on a chip could help develop the global understanding of the central nervous system by modeling a small part of the brain, like the blood-brain barrier, as done in 2013 and in 2017 for an experiment that modeled the interactions between different brain regions. These microchip devices could also be used to test the potential neurotoxicity of new drugs and to study the biomechanical mechanisms underlying neurological disorders. A 3D model of complex neural networks with a cultured neurospheroids used to simulate Alzheimer's disease will be described later in the review as an example of a brain-on-a-chip application. More remarkably, the iPSCs, which are the induced pluripotent stem cells, or those are those iPS cells, combined with brain-on-a-chip technology, can allow the use of personalized medicine in the neuroscience field. So they're going to make little mini brains of you and then put them inside of a chip and then test drugs on them. Well, let's go a little bit further, because there was a story, and I think I pulled this one out of MIT. Here it is. Drug testing could get a boost from MIT's body on a chip. Yes, so there isn't just a brain on a chip. There is a body on a chip as well. Body on a chip may help drug evaluation by replicating multiple organs. This is March 14th, 2018. Computer technology known as body on a chip has been developed to evaluate new drugs and detect possible side effects on several organs before they are tested in humans, according to engineers at MIT. This new system, which is a microfluidic platform that connects engineered tissues from up to 10 organs, can determine whether a drug to treat one organ will affect another, according to findings published Wednesday in the Journal of Scientific Reports. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, has funded the research. Da-da-ling. You know, how long is it going to be once they crack all the secrets of biology? They're able to get different biological systems operating within some sort of contained manufactured environment, such as a little chip. How long is it going to be before they start making robots of humans or human tissues that they then have 3D printed and put into their little biological chip container and then placed into an Atlas bot or something of that nature? I don't know, it just horrifies me when I read about some of the mad science that is going on. You start thinking about where this could lead 10, 20, 30 years from now. It's not a pretty picture. These processes can accurately replicate human-organ interactions over several weeks, as MIT researchers, which could aid in the evaluation of antibody drugs and other immunotherapies. And because the animal and human immune system is different, testing is difficult on non-human trials, but this system could help with that. Some of these effects are really hard to predict from animal models because the situations that lead to them are idiosyncratic. But with our chip, you can distribute a drug and then look at the effects on other tissues and measure the exposure and how it is metabolized. The 10 organ types were liver, lung, gut, endometrium, brain, heart, pancreas, kidney, skin, and skeletal muscle. And the most immediate applications involve modeling 2 to 4 organs. Although preclinical testing in animals can offer information about a drug's safety and effectiveness, those tests may not reveal potential side effects in humans. Animals do not represent people in all facets that you need to develop drugs and understand disease, but that is becoming more and more apparent as we look across all kinds of crazy drugs like DNA nanobots and also other factors in humans, either genetic background, the environmental influences, lifestyle, and other drugs being taken. How are they going to simulate environmental influences at your lifestyle They're going to shoot it up with a little bit of alcohol and blow a little nicotine on it. And that's crazy. A lot of time you don't see problems with a drug, particularly something that might be widely prescribed, until it goes to the market. And all of a sudden, there's a big recall 3 years later because lots of people have died. But MIT researchers pursued this new technology that they are calling physiome on a chip. So physiome, that's a new term. The new equipment will allow tissues to grow and interact with each other and to mimic the functions of human organs. Previously, no one had successfully connected more than just a few types of tissues, but the researchers also solved problems that would allow fluid to flow in and out and a way to manipulate what is happening inside of the chip. Rather than using external pumps, the engineers developed an open system which allows them to manipulate the systems and remove samples. They adapted the system from technologies developed and commercialized through British-based CN Bio Innovations. And these onboard pump controls the flow of liquid between organs, replicating circulation of blood, immune cells, and proteins throughout the human body. They also can create tumors. Hey, that'll be helpful someday. The researchers created several versions of the chip that consisted of clusters of 1 to 2 million cells for each organ. And then they worked with primary cells, and those would be ones that perform much of the organ's function. In a test, researchers successfully delivered drugs to the gastrointestinal tissue, mimicking the oral ingestion of a drug. And then they saw how it was transported to other tissues and metabolized. In this process, they could measure where the drug went and its effect on different tissues and how the drug was broken down. An advantage of our platform is that we can scale it up or down and accommodate different types of configurations. I think this field is going through a transition to where we start to get more information out of 3 and 4 organ systems. It'll start to become cost competitive because the information you get is so much more valuable. But don't worry about it, because if that doesn't work and they can't find the cure to Alzheimer's, they now have an implant that could bring your memories back. Alzheimer's memories could be switched back on with an implant. And this is out of the telegraph.co.uk, March 27th, 2018. Alzheimer's sufferers could once again remember the faces of loved ones or find their way back home. After scientists have developed a way to boost their memories, in a groundbreaking pilot study, U.S. researchers recorded memories as they were being formed and then later played them back to the brains of 10 patients. They found that it increased memory performance by up to 37%. Now, you're not going to guess who funded this research. Oh, the study was funded by the U.S. Department of Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, and focused on improving episodic memory, which is the most common type of memory loss in people with Alzheimer's, stroke, and head injury. Episodic memory is information that is new and useful for a short period of time, such as where you parked a car or where you left your keys. So don't worry about it. All you need is an implant now. This is the very first time scientists have been able to identify a patient's own brain cell code or a pattern for memory and, in essence, write that code and make an existing memory work better, an important first step in potentially, quote, restoring memory loss, yes, or implanting memories. In the future, we hope that we are able to help people hold on to specific memories, such as where they live or what their grandkids look like, when their overall memory begins to fail. We envision this system being made into an implant, ding, to provide continuous support to a person's ability to encode and store new memories. And maybe it'll even be a little DNA nanobot. The patient would visit a clinician periodically to ensure that their system is working within parameters. But this closed-loop system is being designed to continuously read, analyze, and support the patient's innate memory function. Well, this sounds a lot like being under that heading of biocontrol. It's reading, writing, and analyzing your memories real time. Around 850,000 people are suffering from dementia in Britain, and around 2/3 of Alzheimer's, which is a sticky amyloid plaque that builds up in the brain, preventing brain cells from communicating and wiping out your memory. So for this new study, researchers enrolled 10 epilepsy patients who are already participating in separate experiments mapping their brain. And I'm going to add to that. So that means they already have probes in their brain, because we've read about that before. So they already have, and here it says, electrodes implanted in their heads. The participants were asked to study a simple image, such as a colored block, while their brain activity was recorded. And scientists then blanked the screen and asked them to choose a correct image from five options. They found out that when people were asked to remember while playing back the recorded memory into the hippocampus region of their brains, their performance improved by 37%. Yay! The hippocampus is responsible for forming memories and for spatial recognition and is one of the first areas to be damaged by Alzheimer's. We showed that we could tap into a patient's own memory content, reinforce it, and then feed it back to the patient. Even when a person's memory is impaired, it is possible to identify the neural firing patterns that indicate correct memory formation and then separate them from the patterns that are incorrect. We can then feed the correct patterns to assist the patient's brain in accurately forming new memories as a replacement for innate memory function, but as a boost to it. Commenting on the research, British experts said that the study provided important stepping stones into understanding how memories form. And the head of the research at Alzheimer's Society says the future tests using this method in people with Alzheimer's could represent a vitally new form of treatment for dementia. Yeah, how great. Step right up and get your implants. We'll fix your memory. Don't worry about it. All right, so we're going to take another step now into dystopia. And this one caught my attention because in the diagram, there's a little petri dish to suck cells out of. They're calling this 3DIY, printing your own bioprinter. This is out of Carnegie Mellon University, March 27th, 2018. You know, as DARPA is working on all these systems on a chip and you're able to mix and match your own biology, what's going to stop you from having a 3D printer that then you can modify, because it's all open source designs, to be able to print your own cells and create your own little mini organs? It's just crazy. Researchers have developed a low-cost 3D bioprinter by modifying a standard desktop 3D printer, and they have released the breakthrough designs as an open source so that anyone can build their own system. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University have developed a low-cost 3D bioprinter by modifying a standard desktop 3D printer, and they have released the breakthrough designs as an open source that anyone can use to build their own system. The researchers of the Material Science and Engineering and Biomedical Engineering of Carnegie Mellon published a paper in the journal called Hardware X that contains complete instructions for printing and installing a syringe-based large-volume extruder to modify any typical commercial plastic printer. So you can print a large-volume extruder and then modify your existing 3D printer. What we have created is a large-volume syringe pump extruder that works with almost any open-source fused depositing modeling printer. That means it is an inexpensive and relatively easy adaptation for people who use 3D printers already. And as the researchers explain in their paper, large-volume syringe pump extruders for desktop 3D printers, commercial 3D bioprinters currently on the market, cost from $10,000 to more than $200,000 and are typically proprietary machines, closed source, and very difficult to modify. Essentially, what we've developed is a bioprinter that you can build for under $500. So there's the price point, people. So Mad Science Gone Mad is going to get a lot madder. That I argue is at least on par with that of many that cost far more money. Most 3D bioprinters start between $10,000 and $20,000, and this is significantly cheaper, and we provide very detailed instructional videos. It is really about what? Oh, democratizing technology and trying to get it into more people's hands to make it even more of a danger to the rest of the world as you're able to 3D print biotissues. And not only does this component cut down on the cost, but it also allows users to print artificial human tissue on a larger scale and at a higher resolution, opening doors for researchers, makers, professionals, and people in mommy's back bedroom so they can experiment with 3D printing biomaterials and fluids. And if you remember, back a few months ago, we had read about Georgie Porgy Church wanting to get genomes on the blockchain, and then we had read about another company that was looking at putting 3D printers on the blockchain. So now let's modify these a little bit to become bioprinters and some iPS stem cells or body scans of that nature. And you might end up with some sort of device such as a, I don't remember what it was called. There was a show I was watching a while ago. It was something transit where they scanned you and they printed a replicant at a remote location where they could send you and upload your memories and recreate your biological matter. So, all right, where are we going to go from here? I don't know, this is kind of a mishmash of stories, but they all kind of connect in one way or another. The picture on this one really caught my attention. It made me think of a Roman gladiator headdress and facial armor going in battle, but it's actually a wearable MRI scanner. This came out March 23rd, 2018. British scientists develop wearable MRI scanner. So this is how they're going to get a really good scan of your head and how your brain works and what all the connections look like. British scientists have invented a new type of brain scanner the patients can wear in their head that allows them to move around while being tested so they can then measure all the different things that happen in your brain when you're doing different tasks. The device, which looks like a prop from a budget sci-fi or Phantom of the Opera movie, is in fact the latest thing in brain scanning. I think in terms of mapping brain activity, brain functions, this represents a step in change, says Matt Brooks, a physicist at the University of Nottingham. Because you can do this while wearing it, that would be things such as playing baseball or even drinking a cup of tea. And it was at Nottingham University in the early 70s that the MRI was very first developed. But now wearing what they call a MEG system has a potential to open a whole new field of brain scanning. We should get very excited because that's where they want to get into. The scanning records of the magnetic field produced by brain activity can show precisely where in the brain these movements are being controlled. Remember, it is all about control systems and biology. Neuroscientists will be able to envisage a whole new world of experiments where we try to work out what the brain is doing while a person is behaving naturally. For children with epilepsy, of course, this is going to be able to monitor them and maybe figure out how to fix them. This technology is going to be tremendously beneficial, and the reason is that doctors can now scan these children as they are moving about, and that has never been done before. It will also make it easier to scan people with movement disorders such as Parkinson's. Wah, 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 wah. So step right up for your newest brain scan so they can cure you of your epidemic neurological condition. So here's another story, and I think Camille sent this to me a week or so ago. This caught my attention because we've talked about this before. This would be mind uploading. And we talked about this in regards to putting it on the blockchain. They were talking about creating digital autonomous corporations and using mind uploads to be able to create those. Here's another one. This is out of MIT Technology Review, March 13th, 2018. A startup is pitching a mind uploading service that is 100% fatal. So, if you want to be uploaded, we're going to have to freeze your brain and cut it into little splices. The company is called Nectome, which is pretty amusing considering that one of the projects working on mapping out the brain is called the Kinectome Project. Nectome will preserve your brain, but you will have to be euthanized first. All right, so the startup accelerator Y Combinator, and I think that is attached to Peter Thiel in some way, is known for supporting audacious companies in its popular 3-month boot camp. There has never been anything quite like Nectome, though. At next week, the Y Combinator's demo says, Nectome's founder, Robert McIntyre, is going to describe his technology for exquisitely preserving brains in microscopic detail using a very high-tech embalming process. Then the MIT graduate will make his business pitch, and as it says on his website, what if we told you we could back up your mind? So yeah, Nectome is preserving your brain, is the Preserve Your Brain and Upload It company, and its chemical solution can keep a body intact for hundreds of years, maybe even thousands, as a statue of frozen glass. And remember, they've been working a lot on cryogenics, and we're seeing a lot of that in longevity medicine. We also found out, I don't know if we're going to get there, but in the encore presentation of the show that I ran yesterday, we talked about suspended animation. That is something that NASA has been working on in regards to long-distance space travel. And maybe we'll get there, maybe we won't today. But the idea is that someday in the future, scientists will be able to scan your bricked brain and turn it into a computer simulation. Oh, yeah, let's hope so. That way, someone a lot like you, though not exactly you, will be able to smell flowers again in a data server somewhere, and you will be forever trapped. Don't do it, people. But this story has a really grisly twist. For Nectome's procedure to work, it is essential that the brain be fresh. Oh, yes. Still warm. And the company says that its plan is to connect people with terminal illnesses to a heart and lung machine in order to pump its mix of scientific embalming chemicals, oh my God, into the carotid artery in their neck while they are still alive. Though, don't worry about it because it'll be under general anesthesia. This is just like a horrifying nightmare. The company has consulted with lawyers familiar with California's 2-year-old End of Life Option Act, which permits doctor-assisted suicides for terminal patients, and it believes that this service will be legal. The product is, quote, 100% fatal, says McIntyre, and that is why we are uniquely situated among the Y Combinator companies. Brain uploading will be familiar to readers of Ray Kurzweil's books. Right, we've talked about that before many times. Upload yourself to the cloud or other futurist literature. Yet, you may already be convinced that immortality as a computer program is definitely going to be a thing of the future. Or you may think transhumanism, the umbrella for such ideas, is just a high-tech religion preying on people's fear of death. We've talked about that as well. Either way, you should pay attention to Kinectome. The company has won a large federal grant, which is kind of amusing, and is collaborating with Edward Boyden, who is a top neuroscientist at MIT, and its technique just claimed an $80,000 science prize for preserving a pig's brain so well that every single synapse inside of it could be seen with an electron microscope. McIntyre, who is a computer scientist, and his co-founder, Michael McKenna, have been following the tech entrepreneur's handbook with ghoulish alacrity, and the user experience will be identical to physician-assisted suicide, he says. Product market fit is people believing that it works. Nectome storage service is not yet for sale and may not be for several years. Also lacking is evidence that memories can be found in dead tissue. But the company has found a way to test the market, and following the example of the electric vehicle maker Tesla, it is sizing up demand by inviting prospective customers to join a waiting list with a deposit of $10,000, fully refundable if you change your mind. So far, 25 people have already signed up. One of them is Sam Altman. and I think we've read about him before, a 32-year-old investor who is one of the creators of Y Combinator. Altman tells MIT Technology Review that he is pretty sure minds will be digitized in his lifetime. I assume that my brain will be uploaded to the cloud, he says. Yes, of course you do. Brain storage businesses are not new. In Arizona, the Alcor Life Extension Foundation holds more than 150 bodies and heads already in liquid nitrogen, including those of baseball great Ted Williams. But there's a dispute over whether cryogenic techniques damage the brain, perhaps beyond repair. So starting several years ago, McIntyre then worked with a cryobiologist, Greg Fay, at a company named 21st Century Medicine. This is pretty amusing. And developed a different method which combines embalming with cryogenics. Ew. It proved effective at preserving the entire brain to the nanometer level, including the connectome, which is the web of synapses that connect your neurons. The connectome map could be the basis for recreating a particular person's consciousness, believes Ken Hayworth, a neuroscientist who is the president of the Brain Preservation Foundation, the organization that, on March 13, 2018, recognized McIntyre and Fahey's work with a prize for preserving the pig brain. There's no expectation here that the preserved tissue can actually be brought back to life, as is the hope with Alcor-style cryonics. Instead, the idea is to retrieve the information that is present in the brain's anatomical layouts and molecular details. If the brain is dead, it's like your computer is off, but that doesn't mean that the information isn't there. And the brain connectome is inconceivably complex. A single nerve can connect to 8,000 others, and the brain contains millions of cells. Today, imaging the connections at even a small square millimeter of a mouse brain is actually an overwhelming task, but it may be possible in 100 years. So speaking personally, if I were facing a terminal illness, I would likely choose euthanasia. Well, that would be you, the author of the story, not me. The Nectomes team demonstrated the seriousness of its intentions back this January, when McIntyre and McKenna and a pathologist they hired several weeks before had camped out at an Airbnb in Portland, Oregon, waiting to purchase a freshly deceased body. In February, they obtained the corpse of an elderly woman, and they were able to preserve her brain in just 2.5 hours after her death. It was the very first demonstration of their technique called aldehyde stabilized cryopreservation on a human brain. Phineas Lupitu, founder of Eternitas, which is a company that arranges for people to donate their bodies to science, confirmed that he provided Nectome with the body. And remember, we've looked at that before. Always think twice about providing your body to science, because you may show up as a rotting corpse in some sort of forensics training facility, or maybe as a guinea pig in a brain-freezing nectome experiment, as we just found out. This preservation procedure, which takes about 6 hours, was carried out at a mortuary, and you can think of what we are doing as a fancy form of embalming that preserves not just the outer details, but also the inner. He says that the woman's brain is one of the very best preserved ever, although her being dead for even a couple of hours has damaged it. Her brain is not being stored indefinitely, but being sliced into paper-thin sheets and then imaged with an electron microscope. McIntyre says that the undertaking was a trial run for what the company's preservation services could look like, and he says that they are seeking to try it in the near future on a person planning doctor-assisted suicide because of a terminal illness. Hayworth told me that he is quite anxious that Nectome refrains from offering its service commercially before the planned protocol is published in a medical journal. That so the medical and ethics community can have a complete round of discussion. So, crazy or not, some scientists say that brain storage and reanimation is an essentially fraudulent proposition. Writing in our pages in 2015, McGill University neuroscientist Michael Hendricks decried the abject false hope peddled by transhumanists promising resurrections in ways that technology could probably never deliver. burdening future generations with our brain banks is comically arrogant. Aren't we leaving them with enough problems? Hendrix told me this week after reviewing Nectome's website. And in the future, people are appalled that I hope future people are appalled that in the 21st century, the richest and most comfortable people in history spent their money and their resources trying to live forever on the backs of their descendants. I mean, it's a joke, right? They're the cartoon bad guys. And you know, that's what I've been trying to point out here. We've looked at the tech billionaires trying to cure death as a disease so they could live forever. And it's always been kind of a joke, but it's the truth, people. This is just crazy. Nectome has received substantial support for its technology. However, it's raised $1 million in funding so far, including $120,000 that Y Combinator provided to all the companies it accepts. It also won a $960,000 federal grant from where? Oh, the U.S. National Institute of Mental Health, which used to be Tommy Insel's ring, for, quote, whole brain nanoscale preservation and imaging, the text of which foresees a commercial opportunity in offering brain preservation for purposes including drug research. Ding-a-ling. So about a third of the grant funds are being spent by MIT's lab of Edward Boyden, a well-known neuroscientist, and Boyden says that he is seeking to combine McIntyre's preservation procedure with a technique invented at MIT, which is called expansion microscopy, which causes brain tissue to swell to 10 to 20 times its normal size, which facilitates the same type of measurements, just more accurately. I asked Boyden what he thinks of brain preservation as a service, and I think that as long as they are upfront with what we do know and what we don't, the preservation of information in the brain might be a very useful thing, he replied in an email. The unknowns, of course, are substantial. Not only does no one know what consciousness is, so it'll be hard to tell if it's eventually simulated, but it's also unclear what the brain structures and the molecular details need to be retained in order to preserve a memory or a personality. Unless, of course, you are DARPA and you have figured out through different brain scans and stimulation how to insert and remove memories. It is just synapses, or is it every fleeting molecule? Ultimately, to answer this question, data is needed. So Nectome has been honing its pitch for Y Combinator's demo days, trying to create a sharp 2-minute summary of its ideas, and that would be called the elevator pitch to present to a group of elite investors. The team was leaning against showing an image of an elderly woman's brain. Some people thought it was unpleasant. But the company has also walked back its corporate slogan, changing it from "We archive your mind" to "Committed to the goal of achieving your mind." Oh, committed to the goal of archiving your mind, which seems a little like less of an overpromise. McIntyre sees his company in the tradition of hard science startups working on tough problems like quantum computing, and those companies can't sell anything now, but there's a lot of interest in the technology that could be revolutionary if things are made to work. I do think that brain preservation has an amazing commercial potential. Right, then we can pay $29.95 to download Nana at Christmas time and project her as a holograph in the head seat at the dinner table. So where are we going to continue? How about this one? A smart car that can read brain signals. And we have read about the brain reading cars before. Nissan researchers are able to read a driver's brain signals and send them to a smart vehicle so it can anticipate the driver's moves and facilitate the driving process. So we've talked about using mind control for keyboards and mice before to be able to interact with your machine. And DARPA has been doing some of that research. Facebook as well, with Regina Duggan's Building 8 project. There have also been other companies such as Emotive, which we talked about on Friday, I believe, with the mind-controlled drone swarms. Well, now Nissan is looking at using your brain signals as well to drive. Nissan recently unveiled its Brain 2 vehicle, more affectionately known as the B2V technology. Future cars will be both self-driving and manual. We wanted to harness the technology to enhance the driver's skills without interfering with the enjoyment of being behind the wheel. Like I said, self-driving vehicles are going to take away one of my most favorite things to do, and that would be taking a cruise with loud tunes. And as a part, on a nice sunny day, as a part of a joint project with Nissan researchers, the team managed to read brain signals. Hold on one second. Sorry, I had to sneeze. That indicate a driver is about to do something, such as accelerate, to brake, or change lanes, in order to send that information to the vehicle. And with this advance notice of a few hundred milliseconds, the smart vehicle can anticipate the driver's movement and make the ensuing maneuvering easier. The car is also equipped with sensors to monitor its environment, which means it can help the driver when traffic conditions are difficult and slippery. And the signals produced in the driver's frontal motor cortex are detected using a sensor-equipped EEG headset. What? And then they are sent to the smart vehicle for processing. By combining that data with the information detected by its own sensors, the cars can react to the situation at hand. And if you are coming to a red light and ready to brake, the car will assist you by starting to brake 200 to 500 milliseconds before you do. But if you approach a red light and your brain shows no intention for slowing the car down, the car will warn you that the light is red and make sure that you've seen it. We all generate different patterns of brain signals, and they are as individualistic as a fingerprint. So the vehicle will learn from each driver and customize its software. It stores each driver's regular route so it knows where you go, and it bags, tags, and tracks you. And this will be like behavioral monitoring, as well as their driving habits and their style. And it uses this information to more accurately anticipate what each driver might do at any time. The brain-machine interface not only makes driving easier, but also creates a more personalized experience, as the car will always be in sync with the driver, and even the car's settling can be transparently adapted to driver preferences. Hey, I'm going to tell you, I might not get a bumper because I forgot to turn off the rebroad that I had set for Monday and Tuesday, and now my automation software is frozen, so I can't see a live screen to be able to click back the music. So we're going to have to go right up to the end when the 15-second little station ID plays. Since 2015, Nissan's been working on developing this brain vehicle technology, mainly by adding eye tracking function, and our eyes are always moving and observing what is going on, but not everything we see is relevant. So now we're going to use an EEG and be able to scan your brain. So we're studying ways now to detect brain signals that indicate a certain object or situation has caught your attention and needs to be factored in by the vehicle. For several years now, this team has been developing scientific knowledge in detecting and using brain signals to control objects in our environment. And they have been focusing on driver-assisted technologies since 2011, in parallel, we have been exploring other applications for their expertise as well, such as helping people with motor disabilities. And guys, I am not hearing anything. All right, there we go. Everyone have an awesome day.